Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. And, you know, today I'm going to remind you again that we are remote recording now, so I'm in my bedroom, and you may hear a chicken screaming or the wild parrot screaming, but we also have we've got two guests, actually, today, which is wonderful, because I'm very excited to have writer, director, actor Alice Lowe here, calling in from London, correct? Is that where you're at right now?
Yes, I am. I'm in South London.
Yeah, and we also have Alice's baby, Sadie, joining us, so you might hear some murmurings and mumblings over there.
Yeah, I like to have a baby just to, you know, shake things up, a chaos factor introduced. Yeah. I think last time I spoke to you, I had a baby. It was a different one.
Yeah.
But I just always seem to have a baby at some point.
I feel like, I'm thank you for always bringing your baby when you talk with me.
I would feel naked without one, you know. I just have to have a sidekick, basically, to kind of take the heat off me. I don't have to be as entertaining. I can just hand over to my little second in command.
Yes, point at them. And, oh, wow. That's a focal. That's a centerpiece for everything. So for those of you who need a refresher on Alice's career, please let me give that to you right now. Alice began her career in the UK in experimental theater and shows, leading to her casting in early roles on cult shows like The Mighty Boosh and as premonition-sensitive Liz Asher on Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Hers is a familiar face in UK comedy and drama series, a scene stealer in shows including The IT Crowd, Snuffbox, Man to Man with Dean Lerner, Pulling, Skins, Sherlock, and so many more. She starred in Paddington and Hot Fuzz, but often it's more of her cult work that's earned her diehard fans, like that of the film Sightseers, directed by Ben Wheatley, about a wildly inept couple who go on holiday and become bonded and emboldened by their burgeoning serial killer abilities, which Alice also co-wrote with Steve Oram, her co-star. 4 years later, Alice took over directing duties herself with her directorial horror debut, Prevenge, about a very pregnant woman being instructed by the voice of the fetus in her belly to kill the people who she perceives to have wronged her. The film was bought by Shudder for US release after a successful festival run, and she went into development then with her next feature, Time Stalker, for which I hope that we get an update on today, because I have been wondering about that. But in the meantime, Alice can be found in a lot of things. In the film Sometimes Always Never with Bill Nighy, The Days of Bagnold Summer with Monica Dolan, and Eternal Beauty with Sally Hawkins. And I think that there's also another one, Dark Encounters.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I think Dark that
Encounter,
one just came to
which
streaming.
Is on, it's on Amazon Prime at the moment in the UK anyway.
So
I knew that was one I'd forgotten.
I'm glad that I'm keeping tabs in your career, Alice.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
She's also reportedly working on a Delia Derbyshire biopic chronicling the life of the pioneering electronic music artist, which I hope that we also get to hear about. So, Alice, the movie that you chose to talk about today is The Company of Wolves. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
I saw this film when I was very young. I saw it on Channel 4, which would be, you know, your hunting ground for the weird films on a Friday night. Mm-hmm. If you were a nerdy teenager like me, you would be sort of looking in the newspaper and circling which weird films were going to be on Channel 4. And one of those was Company of Wolves. And I don't think I really knew anything about Neil Jordan or... you know, I did know about Angela Carter because I was studying her at school as part of my English. I don't know, for me, it sort of belongs in the fantasy bracket of like Labyrinth and films that I watched that were very much about me becoming an adult, becoming a woman. You know, it was like those films, they sort of spoke to me in a way that I felt a lot of other films didn't like, and they weren't, and films that were maybe sort of slightly underestimated at the time, but now as an adult I look back on them and go, wow, there was something really powerful being tapped into about teenage girls.
That's funny. When Neil Jordan finally watched the cut in the theater the first time, he said, oh no, I guess I made a movie where the target audience is only girls and dogs. But it works, you know? For those of you who haven't seen The Company of Wolves, today's episode will obviously give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch, especially with this movie, because it's hard to describe with in any kind of specificity. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Company of Wolves first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce The Company of Wolves. Based on the book The Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter, co-written by Carter and Neil Jordan, and directed by Jordan for release in 1984, The Company of Wolves stars Sarah Patterson as Rosaline, a young girl napping and dreaming intensely in her family's country estate. We travel into her dreams, which transports Rosaline's family to the 18th century. There, Rosaline's sister Alice is Alice, which is nice. I forgot that that character was named Alice, is killed by wolves, and Rosaline is sent to live with her grandmother, played by Angela Lansbury.
Shall I take her home with me tonight? Her mother's in no fit state to look after her.
If only you would.
Come, Pet.
Want to stay with Mammy?
Mammy's not well, just for tonight.
Come, child, come with me.
Granny loves to tell cautionary tales, and specifically warns Rosaline,
never stray from the path, never eat a windfall apple, and never trust a man whose eyebrows meet.
After recounting a story of a woman who marries a werewolf who she's then forced to behead years later, Rosaline's given a red shawl and returned to her village. There, a boy will not stop pestering her for a date.
I thought maybe you'd take a walk with me in the woods on Sunday after the service. Just a little walk, Rosaline.
Why should I?
I thought maybe you'd want to.
Soon after, the two of them walk in the forest and come across slaughtered cattle. So the village goes out to hunt the wolves who presumably killed the cattle, and Rosaline's father comes back with what appears to be a human hand.
When I cut it with a knife, it was a forepaw, I swear. A grizzled giant wolf. And then before my very eyes.
Whose is it, Daddy? Is it someone you knew?
What do I know whose hand it is? All I know is what I see.
The wolves transformed into humans when shot. So Rosaline then tells a story about a woman who is impregnated by a nobleman and dumped, who goes to his wedding and turns all his guests into dogs.
The wolves in the forest are more decent.
Later, Rosaline embarks on a trip to Granny's house, where she encounters a man whose brows meet in the middle. Oh no! They toy with one another, and the man challenges her to get to her grandmother's house before he can.
I'll make a bet with you. I bet you anything you like that I get to your Granny's house before you do.
He arrives first. Granny tries to fight him, but he transforms into a wolf and kills her. When Rosaline arrives, he's in his human form, and she shoots him, transforming him again to a sad wolf. She tells the wolf a story of a she-wolf who is nursed back to health by a kindly priest, but who still must return to her world through the town well.
But she was just a girl after all, who'd strayed from the path in the forest and remembered what she'd found there.
Soon the villagers arrive, expecting to kill a wolf, but instead they find that Rosaline herself is a wolf too. She and her huntsman wolf boyfriend escape into the forest and join a pack, and then suddenly the pack intrudes into reality, breaking through Rosaline's windows in the real world outside of her dream, awaking her from her peaceful slumber and her innocence.
Little girls, this seems to say, never stop upon your way. Never trust a stranger friend. No one knows how it will end. As you're pretty, so be wise. Wolves may lurk in every guise. Now, as then, 'tis simple truth, sweetest tongue has sharpest tooth.
It is a really hard movie to sum up, and that's also one of the appeals of it, that it is unlike many other films. It's a story within a story. We'll talk about some of the influences that they had in making this, but obviously it's all based on Angela Carter's short stories in her book. But they had an unlikely collaboration. Like, they didn't really know each other before they met at a conference in Dublin. And that's where everything kind of started going with Neil Jordan. So Jordan said, quote, Angela Carter was in Dublin for the James Joyce celebration, and she'd written a 30-page radio play and showed it to me to see if it could be made into a movie. I said it was too short, but if we can come up with a structure where someone is telling a story within a story, a Chinese box structure, maybe I could get all of her short stories in this collection. That was the plan. Then I went to London, sat in her house every day. She'd go off and write, and we finished it in about 2 weeks. It was really Angela's conception that underneath the seeming calm surface of fairy tales is a seething mass of emotions needing to be expressed. They were designed to make young girls afraid of their own sexuality and to never trust a man whose eyebrows meet in the middle, Angela's best line. End quote. So you know, Angela Carter is not a screenwriter. That wasn't her thing. She was really just like, you know, very unpolished 30-page radio play that was like, here's the structure. These are this is the dialogue. This is the story. But Jordan was able to work with her and to make it into an actual feature. And I think that that's an interesting collaboration where you have one person who's more experienced, who's helping the other kind of find a path through screenwriting.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I've been looking a lot at Angela Carter because I think she's had a bit of a revival of interest. Mm-hmm. And I do find myself going, how would you turn this into a film, you know, about her work? And it's really hard because it's so, just Sadie interjecting there. She agrees mm-hmm. with me.
It's so hard.
It's so hard. Yeah. It's so impressionistic what she writes. And it's sort of, it does strike a chord with you, but what mm-hmm. you actually remember about it afterwards, if it's like trying to tell someone a dream, like, yeah, let me tell you about this story, and you're sort of, the narrative seems to take second place to actually the mood it gives you. And that's mm-hmm. why I actually think Company of Wolves is really successful, because you know, I think it was good to see it as a teenager where I had very little critical faculties, basically. I just watched it and went, you know, went to school the next day going, and then there's a bit where his face grows and he's a wolf, and then there's a bit where, you know, that she finds a baby inside an egg in a tree, and you know, it's much more impressionistic. It's kind of like a mood board of a film. You know, there's all these sort of little stories and glimpses of imagery that really work, and I actually think that's a really successful way to convey Angela Carter, because I don't know how else you would do it. And I have looked at a few of her other books, and I think people have probably tried to do it and not really succeeded, because it's so difficult to capture. And it is something very primal. There's something that it's tapping into that you don't quite understand yourself. But it's compelling. Like, I love reading her books, but when I sort of think about trying to turn them into a screenplay or something, I'm just like, how would you do it? I don't know.
Yeah. They don't have, you have to turn off your linear brain.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have that kind of structure. They don't have that sort of very linear structure. So I think actually what he did was a really, really clever job, mm-hmm. you know, job of it. It really worked. Yeah. And I do think, you know, I think I would love to do something with The Bloody Chamber as well. Like, just, you know, short form narratives and would be amazing.
I mean, there's still so much there. That's the thing, is like, even with all of the things that they put into this movie, there's still quite a few stories left to tell from The Bloody Chamber itself, even. When you're writing things, because I want to get back into this kind of like dreamlike state of this and, you know, symbolism, because if you look at Prevenge, like your first movie as director, that there is a kind of primalism in that. And I'm thinking about like primal images and the way that we can kind of like play with them as writers or directors, where it's almost like a shortcut, where it's like, you feel this, you know, like we feel a certain way about a baby. We feel a certain way about a pregnant person because it's a primal image or something. And I was wondering, you know, like even like in the end of Prevenge, you know, there's like a skeleton motif of like the makeup that you're adorning, or like the, you know, like a red dress. And I was wondering, you know, like if you had any comments on utilizing that in your writing, because I know that you're also just a big horror fan.
I am a big horror fan, but I also studied classics. So I studied a few of the kind of ancient Greek plays, which deal with a lot of human emotions, which you kind of go, wow, these human emotions are 2,000 years old at least. You know, they still have resonance. And that was the thing with revenge, you know, the idea of revenge and female revenge and that going back thousands of years to, you know, plays like Medea or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think the things that are going to stand the test of time are the things that really tap into those kind of deep-seated fears about, you know, that are things that make us human, I guess. Yeah. And there will be contemporary stuff in there as well. There was contemporary stuff in Revenge in the sense of, like, how we see mothers now and what our hypocrisies are about the way we treat parenthood or motherhood. So I always mix it in with whatever is sort of feels really, striking a chord with me, like in mm-hmm. terms of what concerns people or what issues are sort of people are grappling with in today's society. But I also think, you know, when you're dealing with issues that are kind of, you know, as fairy tales, really, I think horror is fairy tales. Mm-hmm. I often think this, that... they're just really, really old stories that have stood the test of time because they strike a chord. They strike a really primal chord.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they've survived, those stories. And I'm not into kind of like, I don't mind it when Angela Carter does it, but I really don't like it when I read a fairy tale to my four-year-old and, you know, Little Red Riding Hood doesn't get eaten or whatever. I'm always like, she does get eaten. This is the real world, kids, you know. I mean, I love the end of Company of Wolves. I think that's great that she sort of, you know, spoiler alert, she, you know, she becomes one of them and she runs off with the wolves. You're like, brilliant, yes. You know, she's got this slightly overbearing parents.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it comes to children, I'm sort of like, don't they deserve to hear the proper version of this story so they can make the decisions about yeah. what's wrong or right about it?
Yeah.
Otherwise, aren't fairy tales sort of there to introduce you gently to the dangers of the world?
Yeah, it's like the difference between Little Mermaid Disney version and Little Mermaid the actual version, which is just like horrifying.
Yeah, I know. And yeah, and really sad. I mean, but actually when I was a child, The Little Mermaid was one of my favorites. Like I used to cry myself to sleep with The Little Mermaid about how wonderfully tragic it was. And you know, the Disney film probably wouldn't be the success that it was if they'd sort of killed her off and had her turn into foam at the end. But when I read, I have read the original version to my daughter and I just, you know, that's the ending. And she quite likes it though. I mean, I have to say, I do think that, you know, that's how children become robust about certain ideas is mm-hmm. when the truth isn't sort of totally hidden from them. That's how you introduce the idea to them for, you know, in the future when their grandparent dies or something, that they heard about death but in a safer space, you know?
yeah when their grandmother is attacked by a wolf in the forest. Exactly. We're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more of The Company of Wolves and also Alice's work. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott.
And we host Round Springfield.
Round Springfield is a new Simpsons podcast that is Simpsons adjacent. Mm-hmm. In its topic, we talk to Simpsons writers, directors, voiceover actors, you name it, about non-Simpsons things that they've done because, surprise, they're all extremely talented.
Absolutely. For example, David X. Cohen worked on The Simpsons but then created a little show called Futurama.
Mm-hmm.
That's our very first episode. Yeah. So tune in for stuff like that with Yardley Smith, with Tim Long, with different writers and voice actors. It's going to be so much fun. And we are every other week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Alice Lowe and Baby Sadie. And we're talking about The Company of Wolves. I love that she responds to me. I wanted to get into something that was the reason why this movie was able to get money, was able to get funding, despite it being kind of strange and nonlinear, and this only being Neil Jordan's second feature as a director after Angel. And it was because it was unapologetically British at a time where people were actually looking for projects that felt like they were from the UK. So he said, quote, "It was all Palace Pictures. Stephen Woolley saw it and just started a distribution company and wanted to get into production. I think I had just been talking to Angela Carter about it, and he was the one who had financing to write the script. And after the script, the budget came pretty quickly. Nobody could put the script into any particular category, so people got really excited about it. And there was something very English about it, too. Things like Powell and Pressburger or the Canterbury Tales, something pastoral that appealed to people that they missed," end quote. And, I think that there's something to not watering your movies down, not watering your stories down for a quote-unquote global audience, and trying to appeal maybe to what you know best, whether it's stylistically or narratively. And, you know, that helped. If it had been more Americanized, I think it would have been much more of a horror film in the traditional sense. And Neil Jordan talks a lot about that and the way that the film was marketed in the U.S., but there was a great deal of excitement about it when it was being made. Everyone wanted to see what this young guy was doing that felt like it was an actual, like, UK film. Like, this is English. And I'm curious if that has ever been your experience, or if, you know, you have ever felt like you are striving to reach an American audience specifically.
Oh, I was going to say that... God, that would be my dream if someone was saying to me, we really want it to be really British. We really want to export that as a thing. I mean, because I was often feel like I'm being pressured into making sure a project has American appeal or, mm-hmm. you know, international appeal. Not with something like Sightseers, because that was low budget. And I kind of think the trick for making that film work was knowing what it was and knowing what its strengths were. Mm-hmm. And I think it could have been a really bad film if we hadn't have supported it being totally British and, mm-hmm. and that being its USP. But even then, it wasn't like people were gagging for a British horror film. You know, it was, I don't really ever hear that. And it's frustrating because I do believe in that thing of the more specific something is, the more universal it is.
Yes.
In some ways. I mean, you know, who would have thought that a story about a wizard, a boy wizard in a, you know, British school would be like this massive, you know, mm-hmm. this massive film franchise from the UK, you know, with Harry Potter and stuff. I just think I would love it if people said to me, you know, we want it to be quintessentially British. more because I could just breathe a sigh of relief and do what I want, more than me then going, oh God, it's got to be everything that's British. But yeah, I think it's fascinating that that was what was happening at that time, because I think it really works. I think there's been like fairy tale reboots, hasn't there, like Hansel and Gretel, which I have to say I have not seen, but the American versions of them seem to be like, you know, they've turned it into Lord of the Rings or something. They think it's got to be like, I have a crossbow and I have a sword. You know, it's like some sort of action film or something. And you're like, it's like the misconception about strong female characters, that they have to be strong rather than just being good female characters.
And in fact, let's get into that, because you're talking about the, you know, Jordan was talking about the early days of Channel 4. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, this movie was kind of received with such a healthy welcome, is because like, oh, this is new. We want new, interesting films. But he said that a lot of what they devised, especially for production design and scope of this, had to do with, you know, like going on low budget things and being like, why can't we have what the Americans have when they come over here? Why can't we have these things? Why can't we have a big scope? So he said, quote, One of the biggest influences visually was the series of movies Roger Corman made, The Tomb of Ligeia, The Pit and the Pendulum, Mask of the Red Death, all made out of minimal resources and all smoke, light, and mirrors. But the film that really influenced this is called Saragossa Manuscript, a Polish film, a surrealistic text, and it also dealt with stories within stories. And of course, Powell and Pressburger films influenced the narrative. But a lot of young British filmmakers in the early days of Channel 4 were at Pinewood. George Lucas was doing Star Wars at the time, and one would get very pissed off and say, I would love to do those enormous sets. Part of my feeling was, why does an independent movie have to be tiny? Why can't it have some visual ambition? End quote. And that was his operating principle when he went in with this. It's like, we have a small budget, but like, we need to think larger with that money. How can we be creative and find a world within that world? And I really appreciate that. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about Anton first and his production design, but he went on to do Full Metal Jacket right after this and was very early in his career, only did a handful of movies before he tragically took his own life. But they were all, they all looked amazing. He was a very talented production designer. And, you know, like, let's talk about scope and, you know, the idea of trying to break out of just a small looking movie and trying to make it as large as possible.
I haven't really been able to step into an arena where I have a big budget, but that's what I'm trying to do with my next projects. And it really is that type of thinking of like, we're not making reality here. There are no rules. Like, we can have giant mushrooms if we want to.
Yeah.
We can, you know, and it's so funny the way we've sort of straitjacketed ourselves a little bit as filmmakers, I think, especially in the UK. And, you know, I do look to people like Powell and Pressburger because you kind of go, that was the last time that there was proper visual creativity going on. That's what it feels like, of like people going, this is a visual form. It could be anything. It can be theatrical. It can be magical. It can be whatever. And I'm sure whenever I make a statement like that, there's going to be a load of people going, that's not the last time someone did that. What about this person? And that's this person. Yeah. I'm sure there are other examples, but to me, it's sort of when you're talking to a head of department, like a production designer or something, and you mention, oh, you know, I want someone to be able to climb through the set and then they go into this, or I want there to be hands coming out the walls. You see people's eyes light up. It's not that they don't have the creativity to do that. It's just that they're not usually permitted to be that creative or that imaginative. And I don't know how that situation has occurred, really.
Well, I mean, I think that you're tapping into something that Neil Jordan was also talking about, the fact that he was still coming up against people who didn't want that creativity, not with the producers, just with crew. Production design was all in. Anton first was, and you know, I can say some quotes, but he was very interested in exploring the German expressionist side of filmmaking and, you know, trying to push those limits. Whereas the crew was constantly pushing back and it made things actually pretty difficult. He said, quote, the difficulty of making this film was working with these old, hard, beaten British crews who'd done James Bond and just come off Star Wars, and they're used to totally understandable elements. And there's a sequence at the end where I wanted to construct a crane shot that went from spring to summer to fall to winter. And we had all these lighting changes. There used to be all these jokes. And are we in winter now? Is it the 12th of August in this little section, Governor? When you're making a film, it's terribly subjective and independent, and it doesn't have any known shape. It can be quite difficult doing it with the rude old film crews in London, end quote.
It's funny because I did a commercial recently where we did a lot of back projection, and at one point there was a scary moment, and I was like, can we play around with these lights? Can we just change the lights as we're shooting?
Yeah.
And that was blowing people's minds that I wanted to change the lighting setting. I think it is coming from theater, basically, where you're like, well, this is the trick that I would have up my sleeve to scare people or wrong foot them or manipulate the audience, is changing the lighting setting. But like, for some reason, that in a film setting, it blows people's minds. They're like, oh no, it takes us 45 minutes to change the lighting set up or whatever. Anyway, I shouldn't say that. They were a really good team, and actually my DOP is not like that at all. He's game for anything. But I can understand that it's crew people going, what? Yeah. Well, we're not usually asked to do that.
Yeah.
Like, But if you get the right crew, they're actually excited about it. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. Let's see what happens. And I think it's so interesting hearing about it from that time, that was still pervasive. And I think the thing is, when you've got no budget, why not go for those things?
Yeah.
And that's what I often say to like my producers. I'm like, we can't compete with Hollywood. We don't have the budget. The only way that this effect is going to work is if we think about it in a completely lateral way.
Mm-hmm.
And go, it's not reality. You know, we haven't got thousands of extras. We're going to go, this room's empty. There isn't anyone there. We're going to make that work.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and we'll talk a little more Company of Wolves and also Alice's projects. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fan Time.
And I'm Travelle Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host. And the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fan Time is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ow.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Alice Lowe and a sleeping Sadie. So we'll be very quiet. Probably not. She actually, we're putting her to sleep over here. But hopefully not putting you all to sleep. I wanted to get into some acting process stuff because, as I said before, there were a lot of non-actors with actors in this. Angela Lansbury was the... Obviously, I think like the kind of center point of like acting experience, but you know, she was often acting opposite non-actors in this, and that was, you know, his choice, Jordan's choice, to kind of have that friction of like spontaneity versus practice. And he said, quote, "What happens when you have non-actors and people who've never done it, they do things once and can't repeat them. But when they do it that one time, it's perfect. The professional actors get kind of annoyed because they have to act opposite this unrepeatable, spontaneous element. It makes it more difficult to prepare their next moves. And I think that they also envy the fresh aesthetic," end quote. So it was kind of like enormously frustrating, for instance, for Angela Lansbury to be like, okay, all right, we're going to do this again.
I've got to roll with the punches here. Yeah. It sounds very like he's talking about them as if they're animals or children.
Yeah.
Which actually, that's the thing when you're acting with animals is like, oh my God, they just did an amazing take. So that's going to be the take we use, mm-hmm. regardless of what I did. You know, mm-hmm. we have to use that take. And that's frustrating as well, because also you know that everyone's going to go, the dog's so amazing. It's so cute. And you're like, yeah, what about me? I did a good take.
You're like weeping
like, you
in
know
character.
That all eyes. Yeah, exactly. And all eyes are on the dog, you know. It's like, ah, so unfair. But yeah, I can understand what he means. I mean, I haven't really used non-actors. I have used, for me, it's like, God, I don't need that. I don't need that to be a variable as well. You know, when I'm filming some low budget guerrilla filmmaking on the streets of Cardiff or something, and it's Halloween night and everyone's drunk and stuff. I'm like, I need the actors to be able to, you know, perform amazingly under whatever constraints. And that kind of does mean they have to be actors. But I can see you like when you're on a set and everything's all set up and to them, they needed an element of chaos, perhaps because everything was too controlled.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because, you know, as I said, putting chickens into that environment, it suddenly brings it to life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same as putting like a non-actor maybe. Because the final wolf was a non-actor, isn't he? The final werewolf guy.
Yeah, Misha. I can't remember his last name. He was a dancer. He was in the Royal Ballet and they needed someone who specifically could move his back and shoulder muscles like an instrument. So it would like, because they had multiple shots where they needed him to like pretend to transform. So they needed physicality over acting instincts. And they ended up just getting him, who has like, you know, as a ballet artist, he's already kind of practiced in front of audiences and you know, like kind of remembering things, even if he's not speaking lines. So.
I mean, some people, I told my friend, so me and my friend used to have sleepovers and we used to watch Company of Wolves over and over again on VHS. And part of it, I think, was because we fancied that guy. It was like not a great formative experience in terms of like deciding what kind of man that you want to go for in your adult life. Like, you know, someone whose eyebrows join and they, you know, may sort of lure you into the woods or whatever. I don't know if that was the original intention of the film, but definitely it was an attraction. And I said to my friend, oh, I'm going to do this podcast about the film. And she was so excited, by the way. And she was like, oh, do you remember that guy? He was a really terrible actor. And I was like, was he? I don't know, actually. Well, certainly what he's doing is really stylized. Mm-hmm. And I think actually it adds to kind of the inhuman quality, the fact that he doesn't have this kind of, you know, actors are good at simulating naturalism, even though it's not natural.
Yeah.
And he isn't. He's doing something completely out there, strange.
Yeah, Jordan called it practiced theatricality, because he had to do such overt gestures when he's on the stage in ballet to convey a story with just his hands or his arms, that he was always moving his arms and kind of like positioning his body in these ways where he was just very like over the top in these accents that he was doing with hands and fingers. And
and he's doing this twitching with his head, kind of creepy head twitching thing. Which is usually the head movement for "I'm an alien, I don't quite understand." Yeah. Like Jeff Bridges and people like that do that kind of thing in Starman. It's a bit of a trope, you know, but I like it. I think that it's a bit like actually what, you know, David Lynch gets really strange performers. He often gets performers who other people don't tend to cast because they think of them as being bad actors. Mm-hmm. He sort of almost goes, I like what they're doing, the unrealism of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that, you put it in the right environment, again, a very controlled environment that's very artistically, aesthetically arranged. And it sort of works, you know, and I like it. I think it's great.
There's one story I really wanted to get into, and that's casting Andy Warhol, because he was almost cast as the devil. Neil Jordan said, quote, "We had to cast the devil and it was difficult. Initially, I thought a great devil would have been Andy Warhol. He was his most pallid at the time, most white expressionless face with a shroud of hair. Producer Stephen Woolley sent the script to Andy and went to him in New York, and he'd just been shot by radical feminist Valerie Solanas, but he was terrified to take a plane because of it. He said he'd do it if we could film his sections in New York, which would have been impossible, so we came up with a better devil, with Terrence Stamp," end quote. And there's a certain amount of like things that stunt casting can do for you. And this would have been like a little bit of a stunt cast of just like, oh, we've got Andy Warhol. He's the devil. And like, here's a draw for it, you know, because, you know, his visage was very famous and familiar around the world with certain crowds. And I think that there's a couple things, like you're casting evil, which is hard. You know, like how do you cast a bad person to like exemplify that? And then also can you get a name? Because I'm thinking like in Prevenge, like you've got a couple of guys who are like pretty terrible. And casting bad people's like, who do you cast? You cast the nicest person that you know to be evil? Like who can embody evil, you know?
Yeah, I think you probably do cast the nicest person that you know. I mean, I think that, if you cast someone who's already... I mean, so much of filmmaking is about the tension, you know. It's like, oh, this is too... It's gone too far that way. Let's put something the opposite in there to pull it back. And that's true with, like, score, with, like, editing, like, with so many aspects of it that you're like, we've pushed it too far. Let's pull it back completely the other way. Like, someone like Tom Davis, who plays the DJ in my film, and he's this pretty repellent character, but in real life he's so warm and cuddly and just the loveliest person, and so you're like, you know that the audience kind of love him anyway. So they're not going to go, oh God, actually, you know, I think sometimes in the history of cinema, there's people that are too revolting in a role where they're supposed to be revolting. Mm-hmm. And you actually just want to switch it off. You're just like, no, people have to have an element of charisma, even if they're playing like the ugly person. It's like, they have to be charismatic, well, in their own way.
On that side of things too, you've also played a serial killer or two, multiple serial killers, whether in your own film or Sightseers or something else, where you're like characters that you've written for yourself. And I consider you quite nice.
Just quite, not very, but you know, nice enough. Yeah, I guess it's always a bit of an experiment for me. I'm like, how far can you push the audience to not like me in a way? Because in real life, I'm sort of quite smiley and quite subservient in some ways. Like, I'd apologize to you for stepping on your foot kind of thing. But yeah, I guess I was going to say about Terence Stamp, he's so pretty in some ways. And he's very softly spoken in that scene, which I think is how it works. Mm-hmm. There's no point where he turns and goes, ah, ha, 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 mm-hmm. as he drives off. I don't know if it would have worked with Andy Warhol, I think, because to me, he's like too big a cultural figure from another world.
Yeah.
You know, like would his hair be like, you'd be like, oh, it's Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be going, oh, it's the devil. You'd be like, oh, he's from the 1980s or something. You know, you wouldn't, too contemporary a sort of figure, or from the 60s or whatever. It's like, I'm not sure how that would have worked, but I understand. Again, it's like, let's just try it and see what effect it has. It wouldn't have ruined the film, but I'm a big fan of Terence Stamp, I have to say. So I was just pleased that he...
And this was coming at the beginning of like his career revival as well, because he had like a slow bit, and then he got cast here, and then it kind of started a snowball of things for him. And there are so many great actors in this movie. There are so, like, because there's stories within stories, like sometimes they'll show up and they'll see their way out, but they have so much of an impact on this story and why it's so wonderful. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your work, and then also bringing this film into our listeners' consciousness, because I think it's kind of fallen out of popularity, and I hope that people rediscover it, because it would be nice to see movies like this existing more often.
It is like a 1980s Powell and Pressburger. That's how I think it should be. That's how it should be recast in order for people to take an interest and go back and have a look at it.
For you and your work, can you give us a reminder on how we can see things? I know that
the Bill Nighy film Sometimes Always Never has just come out on a few platforms in the USA. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure which ones, but if you Google it, I'm sure it will turn up. Dark Encounter is available on Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. I think, at the moment, as is Prevenge, actually. And the other films, The Days of Bagnold Summer, I'm not sure if that's had an American release, but it's just had a UK release.
Mm-hmm. I think that's still
that
to come.
On various platforms.
Yeah, here.
Okay, yeah. What was the other film? Eternal Beauty is not yet available to watch, but it will be coming out quite soon. And I was due to film my next film last year, and then I got pregnant, and then the film got postponed, and now we are hoping to film in September, depending on all the guidelines,
COVID willing, yes,
that kind of thing. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
So it is my own personal Don Quixote, that film. It just keeps sort of, you know, it's like the film that I'm going to be trying to get made when I'm 90 or something. But touch wood, we will be filming it really soon. And it's exciting. It's a kind of reincarnation rom-com that is quite dark.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I've seen Prevent.
And expect symbolism will be threaded throughout. It will be a crazy madcap British visual treat.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And
thanks so much for having me.
And also good night to Sadie.
Oh, Sadie's already out. She's gone. And then I'm going to follow suit and go to sleep
Wonderful.
Soon as well.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show. You can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
The wolves in the forest are more decent.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.